Welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by Halt Daddy Hazy IPA, award-winning beer by Greater Good Brewing, built by Penn Staters for PA. Look for the green can at your local retailer.
Hello and welcome to the Keystone Kickoff Show. I am Jim Galante. He is Chris Buccanani. We are talking all things Penn State, Illinois, even from Saturday night. Chris, did you have a good time Saturday?
I had a blast, and judging by the reaction from the crowd at the unofficial whiteout, I was far from alone. It was good stuff, Jim. Want to know this week. That's all that matters.
It was whiteout energy, Chris. It really was.
Yeah, it was really cool. I think that's an encouraging sign that Coach Franklin is able to just strategically drop that suggestion out there, and then it catches fire on social media and in all the networks that constitute the Penn State fan community. And in 5 days, you can pull something like that off. And in many ways, really, it's reminiscent of how the whiteout got started, which is a little bit of structure and guidance from the top. And then it organically grows from there, from the grassroots level up in the fan base. So, yeah, it was really cool to experience. And a great show for the very many recruits who were on the sidelines on Saturday night.
And you know what, Chris? It does not take much encouragement for this fan base to celebrate a whiteout. And why not? It's fun. You put this game at night. There were a couple sprinkles during the day. No big deal. The tailgating was fantastic. The energy level was high all day is what I saw where we were tailgating. It was fun. Folks were into it. We had tailgating people who were at Beaver Stadium for their first game, Chris. First game. And this is what they got to experience, this kind of crowd. It's fantastic. And you know what? Kudos to James Franklin. He handled it well. He handled it very smartly. I loved it. I thought everything was great, starting with James Franklin, through the crowd, and the crowd's energy through the game.
And as I said, the Illini did us a big favor when they knocked off Nebraska, because that elevated the profile of this game. It is certainly a resume builder for Penn State when we're looking at strength of schedule. And it gave the contest a little bit of the imprimatur that we typically like to assign to a whiteout that you don't necessarily anticipate in the preseason, looking at a Penn State-Illinois game. And because of the way, you know, infamously all the game scheduling has changed under the new media rights deals, to be able to just sort of bootstrap a primetime whiteout and have it actually be a game of consequence, two ranked teams, two unbeaten teams, good stuff.
What I thought was interesting also, if you remember prior to the season, a lot of folks thought this was going to be the whiteout game, Chris.
Sure. I think by virtue of the fact that people were looking at it and seeing it as the best and probably only candidate for a primetime game. So, you know, I have continued to maintain that even though Washington doesn't look like they're going to be a very good opponent by the time we get to November, scheduling that game after Ohio State is going to be useful no matter the outcome of the game. It is either going to be, peak insanity level if the Nittany Lions can pull off the improbable upset and finally break that 9-year losing streak to the Buckeyes, or it's going to be a good chance to bounce back. So to get the best of both worlds, to be able to have that down the line in your back pocket for the schedule in the official whiteout, but also get the primetime environment. And to me, virtually indistinguishable from a lot of the officially scheduled whiteout environments, and probably even to the more positive end of the scale, if we were to rank them all, which we're not going to do, at least not till we get to the off season. And so I think it's, yeah, all good.
So in essence, what you're saying is it was smart strategery to correct, make that game the whiteout. Very
absolutely
good. All right. Hey, how about we talk about the actual game itself?
Sure, let's do it.
First impression, first thoughts on it from you.
Well, the team continues to start slow. Nevertheless, my two biggest takeaways from the game, well, let me force myself into just one, because I have three top-line takeaways, maybe four. But the top,
we've gone from one. From
I know. I just I keep thinking more and more things that I think are important.
We got a full hour, Chris, so we can hit them all.
Number one with a bullet is the play of the defense. For as poorly as they played, or at least as well as Illinois executed on the first drive. And really up until the point where they had first and goal at the Penn State 2, and then ultimately ended up missing a 44-yard field goal attempt, the defense after that turned in a masterful performance.
It was, and that seems to be, we're seeing this as a trend now. The defense starting slow. By the second half, they're dominating. Are they making adjustments at halftime, Chris? What's going on?
Well, I don't even know if it's halftime adjustments in this case, Jim. Earlier in the week, and again, I do so many different shows at different times, I can't even remember what I said where anymore, but I know I said multiple times over the course of the week leading up to the game that you saw a lot of similarities between Luke Altmyer and Connor Bazelak, the quarterback of Bowling Green. Well, Bowling Green did some things offensively to take advantage of Penn State's defense that you felt like Illinois was capable of replicating, and that's what that first drive looked like. And so when Illinois gets up on the board first, I said to some of our friends who we were sitting with, I'm not so much concerned that Illinois scored early, because this happens a lot. You get a team come in with a full head of steam, you get their best shot, and they can get on the board. I had just actually watched, before we left for our tailgate on Saturday morning, I rewatched the Penn State football story from the 2008 Illinois game, which was another primetime whiteout against the Illini with some rainy conditions. And I remember that they got on the board first in that one as well. So it wasn't so much the touchdown, it was how they got it. Because your worst case scenario is, can this team, which has some athletes and a quarterback who has been playing very well thus far this season, replicate what the Falcons did to Penn State, but with better athletes. And so, yeah, I was a little concerned about that. But after that initial drive, you got the sense that the defense was already starting to figure things out. Tom Allen was making adjustments before we got into the second quarter, really, in terms of how he was deploying personnel and what the play calls were. Guys on the field were starting to figure it out. So I don't even think it was a matter of halftime adjustments in this one. I think they adjusted quickly on the fly in the first half.
What I thought was interesting is we hear Illinois and Brett Bielema, automatically it's the 3 yards in a cloud of dust. We think they're going to want to run the ball. What was interesting to me is right from the start, Illinois was not able to run the ball essentially at all.
Yeah, I don't want to take away from their lead back, Fagan, who I thought had some nice plays. And if you look at the final team rushing stats, it's probably as the nice runs he had aren't reflected because they lost so much yardage, taking, I think it was a total of 7 sacks. Nice to see the Penn State pass rush show up in a key position. But yeah, in general, I had talked coming into the game that I thought even though Illinois looked like they were going to be capable of throwing the ball, certainly better than they were with Luke Altmyer last season, I wasn't really buying that Brett Bielema wasn't going to play to form and try to control the game on the ground. I think it's clear now, having watched them through that game on Saturday night, that their rush offense, as you said, just isn't up to par from where it was. It wasn't that they were choosing not to run. They weren't running because they couldn't do it.
Yeah, they just plain were not able to do that. It was pretty obvious. And to me, if I were Illinois, I'd have given up on the run earlier than they did. I would have just said, look, if we're going to have a chance to win, it's good. Yeah, it must be shocking to Brett Bielema's system to say it. But if they were going to put points up, it was going to be on Altmyer's arm.
Yeah, and once our defense, I think, started to figure out Jabari Franklin a little bit, and they couldn't really get it going with Bryant, their leading receiver, that really was another one of the key turning points in the game. You just saw the defense settling in and adjusting. But again, to me, Illinois is going punch for punch with Penn State. And credit, by the way, to Brett Bielema and his staff. That is exactly what you thought you were getting, which is a well-coached, disciplined team that doesn't give up. They played well defensively, and they get that situation where their offense, with the game tied, I think, at 7-7, has the ball first and goal at the 2. And then there's a sequence of mistakes by Illinois. The crowd becomes a factor. Penn State really has the crowd as a weapon, as they were throughout the night at key moments. I really felt like the game turned on that sequence. Once they went from the two-yard line to missing a field goal, practically back to midfield, that's really when I started to settle in and think, okay, look, even if some things don't go Penn State's way, they've got this one tonight.
And, you know, Chris, I feel like the longer I do this show, the more I fall into coach speak. And from the Illinois perspective, the mistakes kill you, absolutely kill you. They kill a drive. They're on the two. If you're looking at this from Illinois' perspective, you say to yourself, I'm on the two-yard line. I'm ready to score, to go ahead, going into halftime. I am in perfect position. If I'm Bielema, I'm happy going into halftime with a tie score. But here I have the opportunity to go up a touchdown. You get one bad snap, and the next thing you know, you're missing a field goal, and it's still 7-7.
Correct. Changes the entire complexion of the game, gets the crowd back into it. And again, the crowd absolutely was a factor for Illinois at key moments. And I think it probably gives Penn State some confidence, too, on both sides of the ball, just because of the way it changes the game. And frankly, you can say the same about the Nittany Lions. That game probably should have been a more comfortable win for Penn State. They probably should have covered that 18-point spread. And one of the reasons that they didn't was because there were a lot of self-inflicted injuries for the Lions as well. Penn State made a lot of mistakes they should not have.
They really did. And I was talking earlier in the week to Steve on our show and saying the mistakes, Penn State only had seven possessions, okay? They had nine, but two of them, one ended the first half and one ended the game, you know, right, like one knee. Right. So realistically, they had seven possessions. Two of them ended with missed field goals. And a third one ended with the fourth down non-conversion when they probably could have kicked a field goal if they were a little more confident in their field goal kicker.
Yeah.
So, you know, three of their seven possessions were ended because of their own fault, which more often than not, that seems to be the case with this offense. I want to get into the kicker conversation just a little bit more. Chris, we're going to do that when we come back right after this break.
Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and Cafe Tea from 9 to 11 p.m., and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
Welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by Halt Daddy Hazy IPA, award-winning beer by Greater Good Brewing, built by Penn Staters for PA. Look for the green can at your local retailer.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. It is quarter number two. He's Chris Buccinati. I'm Jim Galante. We are talking Illinois at Penn State, a 21-7 win for the Nittany Lions, Chris. But again, we've got a kicking issue, don't we?
Yeah, and it's, to me, a significant concern because at some point in the season, you were going to be able to need to get three reliably. And right now, you just don't feel like Penn State is safe from any distance kicking field goals. Now, we heard throughout the preseason that there was a pitched battle going on in camp and that maybe Sander Sedahak had the slightest of inside tracks, but that Chase Meyer and Ryan Barker were nipping at his heels, and this was truly a close three-way battle, and it was determined maybe week to week in terms of how all three guys were performing in camp. I will tell you from the practice availabilities I've been able to attend, which for full disclosure is not nearly as many as those who are regularly on the beat, because a lot of times I just end up with a scheduling conflict and I can't get out to Huluba at the time the media has access to practice. But the times I have been there and what I've been able to observe, the kickers look a heck of a lot better than they did last year in a lot of practice situations. So I do think what Franklin has reported as far as the tight nature of the competition for the job is accurate, but thus far we've not seen anything of the other two guys. And I understand and appreciate really that James and, you know, Sanders' teammates are all sticking by him. I think that's great. It's a sign of healthy culture inside the program. But what, you know, one of James's four cardinal rules is compete in everything you do. And I think this has to be a week where that competition is thrown not only back wide open, but even if Sadehack has another slight edge in practice this week, I'm not sure that that is enough based on his history and in-game situations to earn him the first crack at putting it through the uprights next week against UCLA.
Chris, I look at it, it's not a three-way competition for this week. It's got to be a two-man competition, because how they perform on the field has to be part of taken into consideration when you're doing that judgment call on who gets it. Now, I get the feeling, Sahadek, if it appears that he hits the ball solidly every time, okay? And I've used this golf analogy before. It's often I'll be out with my golf partners and, hey, you hit that ball solid. Now, it went way left, but you really hit it well. Right. It appears that he strikes the ball well, but if you don't get it between the uprights, doesn't matter, Chris. He's got to get the ball in the fairway, and that's not happening when it counts. I think they have no choice but to look elsewhere.
Well, once again, that is dependent on the notion that what we're told by Coach Franklin, and again, these little glimpses into the practice that we're allowed, are all factual. This is reflective of the actual situation, that one of these two other guys, Barker or Meyer, actually is neck and neck with Sadehack. Like, what makes you nervous, Jim, is you go out and you see a situation where the kid is consistently failing to perform in what is his only job on the team, and there's two other guys there, and we've not seen hide nor hair of them. You think, well, if that's what this guy is doing for the team, what does that tell us about the other two at his position? So I guess I'm willing to extend the benefit of the doubt, but it does make you a little nervous until you see one of them go out there and do it. And to your point, the job of consistently putting it between the uprights is largely, in my opinion, contingent on what you got between the ears. And this can become a psychological issue. We've seen this with athletes in every sport, right? You get the yips, to use a baseball term, which I know you'll appreciate. And I do understand, like I said, I understand the urge to try to find a way to get Sanders' head right if you believe he's the best for the position. Because we know from the story of Sam Ficken that you can start really low as the place kicker at Penn State, and you can finish on a high. And I think there is some value in trying to continue to work toward that if you coach Franklin and the staff. So I'm not entirely bought in on it's a two-man competition, but I am bought in on the first time a drive stalls against the Bruins, one of those other guys needs to go out there and prove that he can do it.
Yes, and if you recall, that's what we saw a year ago after Sahadek missed. Got another kicker in there, and he proved to be pretty good at it. Just totally, well, I guess not totally off topic, but off the wall question. Wosu, who kicks off, why is he never even in the field goal conversation? Is it that different a skill set?
Again, I can only assume. I mean, don't forget, Jim, he was part of the punting competition a couple of years ago. So, yeah, I mean, it's a specialized skill, and I don't know that. And again, I'm not saying that he doesn't do it. I'm saying that I don't think I personally have ever seen him attempt a field goal kick.
He has not. But
I mean, that guy can't even keep it in between the in the field of play on kickoffs. So I don't know. I it's probably a pretty hard sell to me that somebody who can't, you know, consistently keep it between the sidelines when he's kicking off is somebody who's all of a sudden going to be a massive improvement kicking field goals, even though he's basically never done it in the program. So you're not lighting my pilot light with that idea.
Well, in his defense, I'm not encouraging it. I'm not saying he would be better. I was just curious why he was not even part of the conversation, or, you know, and in his defense, when he kicks off, they have him kick to the left corner every time. Okay. Yeah. He's, you know, it's not like he's got the whole width of the field. All right, let's move on. Let's get to a couple more positive notes.
Let me just note, when I said I had four top line takeaways and the play of the defense being number one, the concern about the kicking situation was number two, because again, that can really come back to haunt you, and you don't want to find yourself in a position, going back to Sam Ficken, that Bill O'Brien was in 2012, where it's like, well, we're just going for it on fourth down every single time because we don't believe we can make a field goal from any distance.
Well, the issue too then, you mentioned next week with UCLA, you got to get another kicker out there. And it's not so much about UCLA. It's about the next game, USC.
Correct.
So can I find a guy that I could confidently put on the field, make a field goal? I don't want one of those other kickers have as their first attempt be with USC down 2 points as time is running out.
Yep. Yeah, so. No, and look, UCLA's defense is not very good. We're not positive we're going to get opportunities to attempt field goals in that game. So you find yourself in the unenviable position of maybe kind of hoping a couple of drives stall at some point and what we, you know, still hope will be a comfortable win, and you get a chance to do it, because I think you're right. I think if push comes to shove and you don't get a chance to see one of these other two in an in-game situation, which is why after the way he kicked at West Virginia, maybe it would have been smart to do this earlier against Bowling Green, or, you know, because that one got tight against Kent State and you didn't do it. I think you maybe have to just roll with Sadehack in the Coliseum and cross your fingers.
Well, I think to James Franklin's credit, after the game at West Virginia, he professed his faith in Sadehack and he looked the part. He hit his next two, struck the ball really well. So it was like, okay, maybe we have a Sam Ficken moment here where the light bulb has gone on and he's going to be fine. But at this point, I'm ready if they get a comfortable lead against UCLA to try to kick a field goal on first down, Chris. Just find out if I've got another kicker. So anyway, I was ready to go another direction, but you know what? Let's do it. You said you have four talking points. You gave me the defense. Now the kicker. What's number three on your list?
Offsides penalties.
Ooh.
Boy, I mean, that looks like it is just going to be a fact of life for this team, especially if Abdul Carter continues to play up to the line of scrimmage. And, I'll freely admit when I'm wrong. I think it was a couple weeks ago we did the For the Bloggy piece where it was a buying or selling or whatever it was on different early season narratives. And you asked me if I was a buyer or a seller on the penalties as an issue. And I said, no, we've got 10 years sample size that tells us James Franklin coaches disciplined teams that consistently finish near the top of the list of the least penalized teams in the country. So I trust them to get it figured out. And these offsides penalties ought to be something that you have plenty of time to clean up between Bowling Green, a bye week, and Kent State. And if anything, they've gotten worse. So this is just it. This is just it. The kid's got a hair trigger. He's not going to fix it. The coaches can't fix it. So you're going to give up 15 yards, some of them in crucial situations, every time he puts his hand in the dirt.
Chris,
that's a big problem. It is a big problem.
Before I respond to that issue, I just want to mention this. Like, I'm going to tell on myself. We did that buy or sell during the bye week. The video was put together by the Ford Bloggy folks. They sent it back to me to post, and they had buy or sell.
Corrected the spelling, didn't you?
No. Okay. I wanted to. Yeah. It said bye week, B-Y-E.
B-Y-E, right.
And then myself, I'm saying, oh man, how do you make that mistake? I can't put that out with that mistake. I'm sorry. They had, BYE. And I'm like, no, that's wrong. It's buy or sell, BUY. And I'm ready to send a text with the correction. And I'm like, oh, I get it. Bye week. Got it. So, yeah,
Well, one lesson I've learned over the years is that the juice is probably not worth the squeeze a lot of times when you try to be clever on the internet. So,
never underestimate the stupidity of your audience. The audience was me. I was stupid with that one. But the offsides, Chris, I'm sorry. I just refuse to believe that's not fixable. It's just discipline, isn't it? Stay your place. Watch the ball. Don't react to anything else. You can't keep doing that. It's too costly. And it's not just Abdul Carter. It's Deny Dennis Sutton also.
Sure. Well, that was as important a game as you're going to get in terms of the increasing escalation of difficulty this season. And it looked just like the first game of the year. It looked like we were playing Kent State. I don't know how many more data points I need to conclude that for whatever reason, this is not going to get fixed. It's something we're going to have to live with. Maybe they can improve upon it, but I don't think they're going to eliminate it. It seems to be naive at this point to repeat the same song that, oh, they'll get that cleaned up in practice this week and then see the exact same thing.
All right. We're going to talk about the other penalties, Chris, when we get back after the break.
Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and Cafe Tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
Welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by Hulk Daddy Hazy IPA, award-winning beer by Greater Good Brewing, built by Penn Staters for PA.
Welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. It's quarter three. He's Chris. I'm Jim. We're talking about the Penn State-Illinois game. And when we finished up segment number two, Chris, we were talking about the penalties, specifically the offsides. I want to talk about some of the other penalties that are so frustrating, the ones that are unnecessary, the late hits, the unnecessary roughness. Those are things that shouldn't be happening. But specifically, I wanted to ask you about the Tony Rojas penalty. What did you think of that? What was your take?
I thought it was lunacy to throw that flag, and I'm glad Jimmy swore on the air when he was asked about it at halftime, because he's right. That was BS. Here's the issue, man. If you go to the SEC, the officiating down there is WWE refereeing. Okay, the fix is in, and it's obvious the fix is in. I mean, there was like that face masking penalty in the Kentucky-Georgia game. If you haven't seen it, just Google Georgia Kentucky face mask, and you can see, I mean, this is pro wrestling stuff, right? Like, you know, Kirby Smart's distracting the ref while Herschel Walker comes in with a steel chair. In the Big Ten, I don't think it's that at all. I think the Big Ten officiating is never a tribute to malice, what can better be explained by incompetence. I think these guys are just bad at their jobs, and Tony Rojas getting flagged for unnecessary roughness, like that's just a guy who can't do his job well. And so James is probably going to have to pay a little fine, but it was well worth it because what he did was tell the truth about what was going on in that game.
Watching it live, I'm in agreement with you. Did you see the replay of the game and hear the official who comes in on the announcing booth to tell us, you know, if a play should be overturned or not, and hear his explanation of it?
I did not watch the TV replay, although my experience has told me those guys contradict what happens on the field practically every time, so they don't hold a lot of water with me, frankly.
Well, he agreed very confidently with the call. You could tell that they didn't think it was an issue or shouldn't have been called, and they bring in their expert, and he said, yeah, that is the definition of the penalty. Doesn't matter if it's, you know, Todd Blackledge was questioning him, and you could tell he didn't agree with the call when it first happened. But the expert comes in and says, look, the defensive player hitting an offensive player, no different than if it was reversed, offensive player hitting the defensive player. When that player doesn't see the block coming, and he totally agreed with the call. I don't know what to think personally. If the way he explained it, though, the rule was interpreted absolutely correctly. That surprised me.
Yeah. Well, stupid is as stupid does.
Okay, let's go with that. But it also, though, it still leads to the question of the not very smart penalties. Let's go to the interception return for a touchdown. Not necessary, Chris. It was not necessary.
Look, I've never played high level football, Jim. So I can't speak to it, but I don't understand what possesses guys. And you do see this a lot. You see it on kick returns and interception returns a lot in the NFL and in big time college football, where the rule is pretty simple. If you can read the guy's name on the back of his jersey, which Illinois does, don't touch him. If you can read the name, don't touch him. I don't know what Zion Tracy was thinking, not just because he blocks a kid in the back, but because that guy wasn't going to catch AJ Harris anyway. Like, he was contributing nothing to the play. All he did was cost Beaver Stadium that distinctive moment to explode and cost AJ Harris a big defensive play. Just, very dumb, very sloppy. Inexplicable, inexcusable.
It ended up in a kind of perverse way benefiting Penn State because they could use more time. They used up the clock. They still scored the touchdown, but that was certainly no guarantee at the time. And the other part to this, you mentioned that on kickoffs, on punts, an interception return, it is obvious. You are right in front of the officials. This play was happening right behind the guy who's returning the interception. It's obvious. You're not hiding this off somewhere on the field across from where, you know, the emphasis of the play is. You're right there where everyone sees it. I mean, anyone watching on national TV, 100,000 people, despite the cheering, you know, with the touchdown, if you were paying attention to the play, you saw the penalty.
Yeah. Yeah, we used to play this version of team tag at recess when I was in elementary school. We had like whoever was it, the rest of their team played defense, and you could pretty much do whatever you wanted to the people who were trying to tag the guy who was playing it. And that Zion Tracy looked like he was playing that game. I mean, I don't know what he was thinking. You know, something. I get it. The adrenaline just kicks in, and everything is moving so fast. So it is what it is. But that was very frustrating. Very frustrating. In part because it's so great when you can have a signature moment at a whiteout. Like, you know, the Joey Porter return for a touchdown, fumble return for a touchdown that wasn't against Auburn. You just want to have one of those. And it's so deflating when it gets taken away.
It does. So anyway, let's go to some of the positive stuff that went on. Okay. I want to talk about this Penn State offense. And specifically, I want to talk about Catron Allen, Nicholas Singleton, and Tyler Warren. And Chris, when we talk about the Penn State offense, I'll often just use the expression weapons as opposed to wide receiver, tight end, running back. Who's a weapon? Who's a guy that you say, you know what? He's probably better than the guy across the way from him. And those are the first three guys I think of this Penn State offense as weapons. And it felt like in that game, play callers, coaches, they recognized it. Do you know out of 65 plays that the Penn State offense ran from scrimmage, out of 65, you want to take a guess how many of those three guys were involved in?
In that they touched the ball?
Yes.
Oh, I'm going to guess 65. I'm going to guess 48.
45. You were very close. And you know what? I look at that number and I say, you know what? That makes sense. I want the ball in the hands of my best players, my best weapons. And those three guys, each one of them is a weapon.
I mean, I have harped on that point since the Mike Yurcich days, and I was encouraged to hear Andy Kotelnicki give his thoughts in the preseason. If it's working, why would you go away from it?
Exactly. Exactly it. And they also hit on, you know, I have this theory that not only do they, you know, load balance a Nick Singleton and Katron Allen, somebody's watching the stats and it's like, wait a minute, this guy's got two more carries, so we give the ball to the other guy. And there's some good reason for it, but I also just feel like they want to make sure, hey, we're splitting the carries. It was Katron Allen, 18 carries for 103 yards. Nick Singleton, 16 for 94. So Nick Singleton, two less carries, but guess what? He has two receptions. So from scrimmage, they each had 18 touches of the ball, each one for over 100 yards. Chris, that makes sense. Feed the beast. Give those two the ball.
Absolutely. They're everything we hoped they would be coming into this season. You're hearing the stats. Only two guys to both have career 2,000 yards, going back to Lydell and Franco. Jim, we've been talking about that here on this show since the summer, the comparison between that great tandem of Penn State tailbacks and the ones we're fortunate to be able to watch today. I thought that especially in the third quarter, Penn State's ability to run the ball consistently really wore down the Illini defense and gave us an advantage heading into the fourth quarter. And let's give some love to the Hog Mollies. They don't put up those stats unless the offensive line plays really well, especially run blocking. We've harped on this one, too. The last several years, the O-line, I don't know if you want to say it's the absolute strength of the team, but it hasn't been the weakness. It hasn't been the key liability that decides games. And once again, that appears to be the case for Penn State through four games, four different situations, and this is a line that sent three players onto the NFL last offseason. So, yeah, that's very encouraging in my mind.
Yes, they were very impressive. They just took over the game as far as running the ball. And now it looks like Tyler Warren in the Wildcat is going to be part of the offense.
Yes, I do like that package overall. I like what he brings to it. I like that you utilize his versatility in creative ways. I will say probably my least favorite play call of the night was going to Warren in the Wildcat on that fourth down conversion attempt. That's a situation where you've got Drew Aller, and I understand that he's not having his best night. That was the fourth of my 4 points, by the way, that we saw some regression to the more tentative version of Drew Aller. But in a way, I think the silver lining is this was his worst game of the season, and it was better than a lot of his average games last year. You've got Drew Aller. Just let one of the best quarterbacks in the country, maybe the best in the conference, try to make the play for you in that situation. So I did not love that play call. The play call I really did love, I liked a lot, was the Nick Singleton play where it first looked like he maybe had fumbled. It was ruled a fumble on the field. Yes. Illinois thought they'd recovered the ball, and then it's handed back to Penn State after the review. I thought that's a sudden change moment. That's a momentum shift. Take a shot right out of the gate on this. And Penn State did. They took a deep shot with Amari Evans. And the Illinois back did exactly what you're coached up to do, which is if you're beaten on a deep pass like that, just chuck the guy and eat the 15 yards. But I like the fact that Penn State went for the kill right out of that sudden momentum change.
Which, again, goes back to Andy Kotelnicki and his play calling and that going deep. Which game was it? The announcer said Andy Kotelnicki has as just part of his concept is you go deep every X number of plays. And we talked about it all last year. At the very least, even if you don't connect on it, you're telling the defense, we're willing to do it. You've got to at least respect that we could go deep on you.
Right. And you can get a situation like Penn State did, where the best case scenario is that you're going to hit a long play, but just down from that is that you're going to get 15 free yards because the defensive back is basically forced to commit PI to not give up the deep catch.
Yes, and Amari Evans was open. He beat his guy. Drew Aller was a little late getting there with it, and I'm glad you mentioned his performance because – he was a little bit off. I want to talk about that a little bit more after the break, but you put it well. Even what we looked at as a little bit below par for him was still as good or better than some of the games we saw from him last year. And I thought it was just he was off a little bit after starting the game fast. I thought he was throwing darts early. He looked like he was really on. We'll talk about it more when we come back.
Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and Cafe Tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
Welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by Hall Daddy Hazy IPA, award-winning beer by Greater Good Brewing, built by Penn Staters for PA. Look for the green can at your local retailer.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. I'm Jim, he's Chris. We're talking Penn State, Illinois, 21-7 last Saturday evening. Chris, pretty good performance, but we're talking about Drew Aller and him being off. And I got a lot of folks talking about that Aller was off. He was a little bit happy feet. But I thought he started really hot, and it didn't look to me like the same kind of concerns from a year ago. A year ago, I felt when he wasn't going well, he was indecisive. Didn't really, to me, seem like that was the situation so much on Saturday. It was just his throws. He was just a little bit off, which I think happens to almost any quarterback.
Yeah, I think there was that. I do think there were some flashes of the old indecisiveness in the second half. But and he missed a couple of open receivers. He just didn't. He completely missed that. Yes. He had a touchdown. Yes. To Trey Wallace. He missed a wide open Tyler Warren, and that and by missed, I mean, he didn't see him. He didn't see that was where to go with the ball. But he also made some great throws. He threw a laser to Warren through traffic that when I saw him release it, I just sucked in my gut. But then the ball got there so fast, so precisely, right in the numbers for Warren. And you know, almost every time he's going to make that play for you. I leaned over to my wife and our friends who we were sitting with, and I said, there are very few college quarterbacks in the country who can make the throw that Drew Aller just did. So there were some good things as well.
Yes, there were those moments when you just know this is a guy who can make some very special throws, throws that you're not going to see from very many quarterbacks throughout the country. Speaking of the whole country, how's that for a segue, Chris? I did want to, you like that? I wanted to hit on a couple other games that went on and where the things are, the national picture. And I want to highlight a couple calls. I'm not even sure if you saw them or not. The first one was Friday night, Virginia Tech, final play of the game, old friend Brent Pry. They throw up their Hail Mary into the end zone, crazy scrum, back of the end zone. They all come down, not sure who has the ball. A Miami Hurricane rips the ball out, runs out with it. The Miami fans start celebrating the win. But before you know it, the officials are signaling touchdown for Virginia Tech. And it goes to replay, of course, as it should. Chris, I'm not sure there was a replay angle on it that showed anything definitive.
Yeah, I agree with that. For folks who didn't see it, there were a lot of bodies down in the back line of the end zone, and you didn't have a great angle. For certain, at points, the ball was moving around. It looked like at least at the high point of the catch, there was almost a simultaneous possession situation where the Tech receiver and one of the Miami defensive backs both had hands on the ball. If you were to put me to it and say, what do you think happened there? I think it was an incompletion. I don't think it was a pick, and I don't think it was a catch. The issue becomes that the ruling on the field was touchdown, and we are told that overturning the call on the field requires indisputable visual evidence. So when you look at a replay for 5+ minutes, as the officiating crew did at the end of that game, it's a tough sell to me that you've seen something indisputable, because you've picked through it like the Zapruder film for 5 minutes before you came to a conclusion. So that doesn't cross the threshold of indisputable in my mind. And I do think, generally speaking, we maybe help ourselves just in terms of moving the game along and improving the quality of the product to put a timer on these reviews and say, hey guys, you got 2 minutes. And if you don't change the call in 2 minutes, then the ruling on the field stands. So probably it was irresponsible of the officiating crew, unless they were really, really sure, to call it a touchdown. What would have been the better approach is if you're going to say, well, we'll just fix it in replay, which, to be fair, does seem to be the solution that is taken in both the pros and college more and more. And I can kind of understand it, because this stuff happens so quickly and you do want to get the call right. Then call it an incompletion on the field and give yourself the opportunity to overturn the call with definitive evidence of a catch. Don't do it the other way around. Spend 5 minutes under the hood and then come up and say, hey, LOL, JK, the game's over.
Yeah, that's where I'm going with this is, I believe the ruling should have been an incompletion. I got a feeling somebody in that scrum was lying out of bounds and got their hand on the ball.
Yeah, could be.
Which immediately makes it an incompletion. But there was nothing on the replay that showed me that definitively. But if you put a gun to my head after watching all the different angles, my best guess was it was an incompletion.
Mm-hmm.
But they're telling us that's not how we rule. We're basing it on we have to have indisputable evidence. So it's kind of like the play, I guess it was the West Virginia game when Penn State gave an absolutely poor spot to Penn State, but on replay, you never actually saw the ball, but you could assume by the position of the player, he made the first down, he made it. But hey, we never saw the ball, so we can't turn it over. We can't change the ruling on the field. The same thing here. I don't think there was anything in the replay that was definitive, but they went that way. You're going to go with the conspiracy theory, though, Chris. You're going to say, this is ACC. Miami's really the only team in the ACC who could be an undefeated, you know, top-ranking team. But are you a conspiracy guy?
Not in this situation. No, I don't think there was any call from the headquarters to change the outcome of the game. Going back to what I said about Big Ten officiating, don't attribute to malice what can better be explained by incompetence. These guys are part-timers who have no accountability. So, when they don't have to stand in front of the media and answer questions about why they made the calls they did and how they did their jobs, and then, you know, they hop on a plane and they fly back to selling used cars for the rest of the week or whatever it is they do as their quote unquote real job. How seriously am I supposed to take it?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Big Ten officials, because the other call, and I know you were at Beaver Stadium as I was, I had to go find this and I had somebody else tell me about it. Michigan was beating Minnesota pretty decisively. Minnesota makes a big comeback. They are down by 3 points late in the game, so they onside kick. And, Chris, they recover it.
Yeah, I was doing an event up at Medlar Field in the afternoon, and before we started, I did get a chance to see some of the ends of the noon game, so I saw the sequence you're describing.
And, we have a problem, though. This is Michigan. This is Michigan. We can't let them lose, can we, Chris? All of a sudden, one of the Minnesota players was offsides on the onside kick. Conspiracy?
I'll just say this. I may have even said this on this show last week. It has been amusing to me to watch the utter astonishment and incredulity of the West Coast media in reviewing the tape from the USC-Michigan game, and their just utter bewilderment at the number of obvious holding calls that weren't flagged on behalf of the Michigan Wolverines. I mean, we remember 1993. We remember how new members are welcomed to the conference when they are playing the two kings of the Big Ten, right? Who's to say, Jim?
But it was interesting because I was just following the score. You know, that was right. all I got. And one of our late arrivals to our tailgate were like, hey, did you see the end of that game? And one of the two guys, he was actually a football official. So this wasn't somebody, you know, not that it takes an official to tell you what all sides is, but I saw the replay. I had to look it up and find it. And, you know, it was just typical Big Ten officiating. Like you say, Chris, you make the decision whether it was a conspiracy or incompetence, but you could go either way when you're talking about Big Ten officials.
Across the board, I think Big Ten officiating is riddled with incompetence. I mean, just to be fair, I cannot say enough unflattering things overall about the officials that the Big Ten puts on the field from week to week. In fact, I think it's disgusting and embarrassing and has been for years upon years that this is a multi-billion dollar product and this is what they serve people. I mean, it's gross and there ought to be perhaps a federal investigation into it. Nevertheless, I think in most cases, it is just an example of people being remarkably bad at an admittedly challenging job. There is a conspicuous amount of incompetence when it comes to the Wolverines, however. I dare I say even a suspicious level of incompetence.
I'll take that. Suspicious level of incompetence when it comes to the Wolverines. Got it, Chris. That's fair. Finally, on the national picture, Chris, Georgia and Alabama. Again, this game was going on during the Penn State game. But just following along with it, oh my goodness, a classic. And my angle to this is we were supposed to look at this, oh, it's a diminished regular season. And people will point at this and say, hey, a year ago, this could have been like an elimination game for the playoffs, something to that effect. I don't think there was any less interest in this game because there's a 12-team playoff, and there's a very good chance we're going to see both of these teams still make the playoffs.
Yeah, and it absolutely changes the complexion of the regular season for Georgia, does it not?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
It substantially narrows their margin for error, especially because you saw Kentucky upset Ole Miss. And then, you know, it raises the question, is Georgia bad because they almost lost to Kentucky, or is Kentucky just better than we thought? Yeah, look, it's changed the nature of the sport. There's no question. I'm not entirely sold that the regular season is now like so substantially cheapened by it. And yeah, it was, I mean, it was a very exciting game. Even the parts that I was able to watch after our game was over.
Chris, I only think that it hasn't diminished the regular season. I feel like it's enhanced it. There are so many more games that are a factor. And literally, you know, I know this sounds crazy, but Illinois was undefeated going into this game against Penn State. At halftime, it's tied 7-7. If you're an Illinois fan, are you not saying to yourself, well, can't you just dream on a playoff invitation?
I'm sure there were some folks in their fan base doing just that.
I'm sure there were. To me, that's a good thing, Chris. That the more teams that think they can make it, I think it's exciting. I love it. Chris, that's going to have to be the final word. Appreciate your input. Thank you all for listening to our show. Make sure you join us next time on the Keystone Kickoff Show.
Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and Cafe Tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.